That's the Mingus Big Band with the wonderful and legendary song, Haitian Fight Song, composed and written by the legendary bassist Charlie Mingus. It's from the 1999 album Blues and Politics. This is Lead Stories. I'm your tree's lead. And, oh my goodness, it is Thursday, January the 15th already. And as Haitians observed on Monday the fifth anniversary of the devastating 7.0 magnitude earthquake that killed more than 200,000 and all but destroyed the nation's capital, they were experiencing aftershocks, though of a political kind. Haiti's parliament is dissolved, and its president, Michel Martelly, is now ruling by decree. A newly installed prime minister, Evans Paul, has taken office, but without a vote, either by the people or the disbanded parliament. Protests demanding Martelly's ouster and free and fair elections are increasing, both in frequency and in intensity. Veteran journalist Kim Ives, editor with Haiti Liberté, a news weekly serving the Haitian diaspora. He's been with us many times, including just last month, and we'll follow up on his report today. He has just returned from Haiti, and he's filing a comprehensive report today on Haiti's political earthquake. It is always a pleasure, Kim, to have you with us, and I thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Yutris. The pleasure is mine.
Well, you just returned yesterday from Haiti. Give us a sense of what you took away with you in terms of the big picture.
Well, the big picture is, once again, Washington has completely misread, misunderstood, and mistreated Haiti, and this on the fifth anniversary of that terrible natural catastrophe on January 12th, 2010. The Haitian people have been fighting for their sovereignty for the past decade. They've had a UN military occupation with its boot on their neck for the past decade, following the February 29th, 2004 coup d'etat against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And they inserted the current president, who is now, we can say, beleaguered, President Michel Martelly, in very irregular and quite illegal elections in March of 2011. And now here we are almost 4 years later, and the people are fed up. I stayed for 2 days in the hilltop slum of Fort National in Haiti. It's very similar, one could say, to Cité Soleil. A house consists of maybe a 4x9 corrugated tin room made with maybe cinder blocks, if you're lucky, piles of rubble and garbage litter this moonscape, which is the Fort National area. It's infested with flies and rats and birds, and it's a sewage running down through the streets. It's just a terrible place, and as people live in these conditions and sink deeper into hunger and misery, the government trumpets every week that, as the posters along the roads in Haiti say, Haiti is moving forward, Haiti is advancing. Well, in the first year or two, the people gave Martelly and his crew, even though they knew they came in illegally, the benefit of the doubt and said, okay, let's see what they can do. But now they're fed up. And the result is absolutely pitched street battles between the police and demonstrators. I almost got hit in the head with a rubber bullet myself out there. Essentially, the police start firing at the demonstrators with first tear gas, rubber bullets, then these water cannons along with these big black tanks that they drive around. And the people respond with bottles and rocks, and it's very classic, it's real battle. And I think the U.S. has tried to stabilize this by pulling out a kind of a recycled politician, Evans Paul, and inserting him as the prime minister, hoping that would somehow cool out the people, because Evans Paul used to have somewhat progressive credentials. But as I say, they've totally misread, because the people, if there's anybody in Haiti the people distrust more than Michel Martelly, it's Evans Paul. And so in a way, they've thrown gasoline on this fire. Mm-hmm. And Haiti hasn't yet made it into the headlines of the U.S. I mean, you are, as usual, Utrecht, in the vanguard here, but it is definitely a major, major crisis brewing, and I can't see how Martelly is going to survive, and I think this country is in for a very turbulent 2015.
Well, I want to take some cues from you to ask you the next question. And you've referred several times to Washington and what Washington wants and what Washington has done. So it is no longer a secret that, in effect, Washington has very, very heavy sway in the internal affairs of Haiti. How is this being regarded by Haitians?
Well, I think, again, they don't even realize they're oblivious to the affront they give Haitians when Pamela White, the ambassador, goes to the parliament and is invited to more or less oversee the session when they put out statements about what Haiti should do. I mean, it's as if we're living at the turn of the 20th century, not the 21st. It is the most arrogant and outrageous insults added to the injury already to Haiti's sovereignty. And the irony is that it doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat. In fact, most of the meddling in Haiti has been done by Bill Clinton, as we've discussed before on this show. He posed himself as the proconsul is what they used to call it under the French colonial regime, as the proconsul who was going to save Haiti. There used to be a proconsul back in the French colonial days of Saint-Domingue called Sontanax, and he was a very liberal guy. He often said what the people liked to hear, but you know, fundamentally, he was working for the French Empire. And very much that's the case with Clinton, but I think he totally lost all credibility when, as Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe, or ex-Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe, was being chased from power on December 13th. He stood there saying, oh, this was the greatest prime minister Haiti ever had. What a fantastic guy. The people were just completely thunderstruck, dumbfounded by this impertinence of this former president from the U.S. telling them that the person they were chasing from power was good for them. So Washington, I feel, has a complete disconnect. They really don't get Haiti. They don't understand the anger and the hunger and the desire of the people for self-determination. And really, that's what we're seeing in the uprising that's now in full swing in Haiti today?
I come to this because usually, you know, most countries, when they control another country, they try to observe at least a modicum of modesty and to hide their hands. But we have U.S. Ambassador Pamela White visibly involved. We had Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton visibly involved and literally calling the shots. And I wonder how come this has not reverberated here in the United States, that we don't get a reaction as to the overt involvement and essentially the running of another country so openly, so blatantly, that this has not popped up as a cause for concern in Congress.
Well, unfortunately, I think it's the result of what one book's title is, Haiti's Bad Press. That is, since the Haitian Revolution in 1804, the first and last successful slave revolution, the first independent nation of Latin America that, in fact, became the touchstone for all the other liberation struggles across Latin America through its support of Bolivar and the revolutions on the continent. Ever since that 1804 revolution, Haiti has been vilified and denigrated as basically a savage people that cannot rule themselves. They don't get democracy. They're not, they're basically not fit to, they're a failed state, I guess is the current moniker they give countries like that. So this is how this has seeped on one level or another into the subconscious of so many Americans, even African Americans, even Latinos, even people who may know of the Haitian Revolution and think of it as something good and be sympathetic to it, yet their picture of Haiti and Haitians is basically of a dysfunctional people, which is really as far from the truth as it could be. I mean, this is a truly dignified, I could say, conscious and sophisticated, politically sophisticated people who have been fighting against tremendous odds for their sovereignty and for their democracy. And so when these U.S. officials come into Haiti and start to strut around and make pronouncements and say we're going to do this and that, the reason that it can be swallowed, I think, by the people in the U.S. who might be in solidarity with the Haitians is because many of them have this maybe often unconscious notion that Haiti really is a basket case, as U.S. Embassy officials often say, and need that help. So they have to, people really, and we need to, in the progressive press, really work hard to push back against this denigration and demonization of Haiti.
Well, let's go to the heart of the matter, and that is this political earthquake. Could you give us the component parts of this earthquake?
The component parts really go back to the election that was rushed through, we can say, by Washington in November 2010, just 10 months after the earthquake, and March 2011, the second round. The first round in November 2010, November 28th to be precise, was a complete fiasco, a total mess. And this was largely due to the heavy hand and, again, totally outrageous role of the international community, i.e. the U.S., France, and Canada, in a sovereign Haitian election. There were ballots and missing, and there was all kinds of irregularities. And almost all of the candidates, including Michel Martelly and his second round challenger, Mirland Maniga, held a press conference and said, we have to redo this first round of the election. But that night, the head of the UN mission, the MINUSTA, as it is called, the Mission for the Stability of Haiti, that's the UN acronym, a guy called Edmond Millet, called both Maniga and Martelly and said, listen, don't worry, you're going to be in the second round. You know, pull out of that group of 19 candidates calling for the thing to be redone. And opportunists that they are, they said, okay. Now, there was only one problem. Martelly did not place in the top two. He came in third after Jules Celestin, who was René Préval's, we could say, party and appointed successor. So the U.S. was not happy, though, with Préval or with Celestin, because they were too close to Cuba and Venezuela, particularly in engineering and pushing through a Petrocaribe deal, which we outlined in Haiti Liberté and The Nation magazine as, you know, one of the big problems Washington had with Préval. So what did they do? They sent in an OAS delegation, which in the words of the OAS ambassador himself to Haiti.
The OAS being the Organization of American States. I just want to...
Correct. You know, Organization of American States. So Ricardo Seidenfuss, he said the OAS didn't just overrule the Haitian Electoral Council, they overruled the Haitian electorate. And essentially, they put in Michel Martelly in this electoral coup that was held on March 20th, 2011. They kicked out Jude Celestin, who placed second, and they put Martelly in his place, and they held the election, which, again, the Haitian Electoral Council never agreed with. They said that is not how it went. So the people, the Haitian people, they've become used to this big stick policy of the U.S., and they said, well, okay, they put the guy in, let's see if they're going to do something. And the fact was that they started this huge propaganda machine to basically not only trumpet all their accomplishments, which were practically nil, but the accomplishments of Préval, you know, a road here, an airport there, a school here, a hospital there. Many of these were being done either by NGOs or had been done by Préval and were completed in the first months of Martelly. But Martelly was taking credit for everything and always saying, oh, we have 24 hours electricity in the capital. And you would look across the capital, you see half of it black, you know, with the blackout. So, you know, it was these patent lies, what they call in Haitian, jeshesh, dry eye. You would just say these things to your face. The sky is pink. Can't you see the sky is pink? So the people began to be really, how could we say, annoyed with this kind of in your face. I mean, we know about it here in the U.S. It's the same way when they're going to make something to pollute the waterways. They'll call it the Clean Water Act, right? So this was just what Martelly was doing on the to the power of 10. And it got to the point in the past year where essentially the cases of corruption, I mean blatant corruption, reached a point where it just was too much, especially when you're in an incredibly miserable position and where you have, say, gasoline prices the world over dropping down like a rock, and in Haiti they were raising gasoline prices. Here we're paying what, $2 and change a gallon. In Haiti, it's over $4 a gallon. And all this is fixed by the government. So things like this just began to, the people said, that's it. You're done, you're going, you're out. And the last thing I'll say, Utrice, is that the Martelly group was very much a photocopy of the Jean-Claude Duvalier regime, which was in Haiti from 1971 to 1986, which was really a kind of a hybrid regime between the Haitian bourgeoisie, what the even the international diplomats called the MREs, the morally repugnant elite, and the old Makut dinosaurs who, you know, are ready to use these thugs to basically club, beat, or shoot anybody who gets in their way. And so the sort of neo-Duvalierist regime, which basically until his death last year honored Duvalier at every opportunity they possibly could, was really beginning to grate on people. And the opposition now has come together, I could say, in a pretty broad front, fairly unified, and are really trying to push back. But once again, you know, the laboratory, as they call it, the Washington group of local government officials as well as bureaucrats always has a lot of tricks and initiatives up their sleeve.
Well, since we last talked, but at the time that we did talk, there was, of course, the Lamont was about to make his exit. He did. Evans Paul has come in, except without a vote, from a popular vote. And, of course, by then the parliament had been disbanded. So his legal status is without question illegal. And now we have the opposition forming and growing in intensity, and there is now talk that the opposition is perhaps even preparing to stage a coup. Is there any legitimacy to that rumor?
I don't think it's a coup. I don't think anybody is going to be taking up arms and storming the Winter Palace, as it were. But I think that the street is really what's leading Haiti right now. The politicians, I'll say in the opposition, you have really three currents, or four, but I'll do the principal three, which is one called MOPOD, that's the Patriotic Movement of the Democratic Opposition, M-O-P-O-D, MOPOD, which is really the traditional politicians. I mean, you'll find people like Mirlan Maniga in it, and a number of other politicians, many of whom were involved, we must say, in the 2004 coup against Aristide and even the 1991 coup against Aristide. The second group is the group of, I could say, the Lavalas family, and I think the U.S. is really thinking about maybe trying to court them. This is, of course, headed by President Aristide, and it has been really the most moderate current in the opposition. That is, the leadership of it has been. Its base is mostly, most of the streets and most Haitians identify with the Lavalas family party. But again, its leadership has been the most temperate. They never were the ones actually calling for Martelly's resignation. They called for Lamotte's resignation, the freeing of political prisoners. Basically, everything that Martelly has given so far has been what the Lavalas family was demanding. But fundamentally, their vision is a kind of a social democratic vision. They're trying to reconcile what I would argue is irreconcilables, that is essentially the Haitian people with the imperial powers or with the Haitian bourgeoisie. And that reconciliation has never really proven to have been able to happen or at least last. And the third current, I think, is the Dessalinian current. Jean-Jacques Dessalines was the father of Haitian independence. He is the one who basically said that we're not going to be able to survive as a colony of France, which was Toussaint Louverture's idea. And Toussaint is, by the way, sort of the model of the Lavalas family and of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Dessalines was much more radical. He said, we have to break with these people. They're incorrigible. We're never going to convince them to look at us as human beings. We just have to go it alone. And he was the one who really led the battles and the people to Haitian independence. And so that Dessalinian current has sort of two parties in it, one called the Dessalines Coordination, which is kind of a more elite, when I say elite, I mean politically sophisticated group of solid militants. And then you kind of have a larger pot of kind of different tendencies and maybe not as solid people in a thing called the Dessalines Children Platform. Both of these kind of take as their leader a very charismatic senator called Moïse Jean-Charles. So those are the three currents, and essentially those three currents have been working in some fairly close unity in the past few weeks. And I don't think, though, that any coup, they don't have any coup in mind. They're just looking to basically run Martelly out of town, as they have done in the past, Jean-Claude Duvalier in 1986 and his neo-Duvalierist successor, a guy called Prosper Avril, in 1990. So it can be done. It has been done in recent Haitian history, and I think that's what the opposition is hoping to happen again.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out. I really had meant by coup like a popularist kind of coup, the force of the people eventually forcing the political changes that they're calling for.
Yeah. Right, more of a revolution. Well, I think they are hoping for some sort of at least political revolution where essentially, Martelly will step down and will resign. And they're doing this simply by making the country ungovernable tomorrow. The next day and the next day are all seen as days of demonstrations. And there's only so many days that, you know, the ruling class and the foreign businessmen and so forth in Haiti can endure these demonstrations and the anxiety they produce. And eventually they may say, listen, Mr. Martelly, thank you for your service, but it is now time for you to go. And they'll try to come with their own solution that we don't know what it is just yet.
In the meantime, though, Martelly has been very wily and very successful at being wily. He has gotten exactly what he wanted. He is now, in effect, a dictator of Haiti.
Yes, he has been very wily, but he basically laid out his plan back in 1997 in a Miami New Times interview he did with Lise Ackerman, and he said, you know, the first thing I'm going to do as president is get rid of that parliament because you can't do anything with them. So he was, pretty open about what he was going to try to do and essentially had an approach of not giving any concessions or compromising in any way with his political opponents and then blaming it on the political opponents, saying they're not compromising with me. So it essentially became a tactic, though, that became pretty transparent to everybody. And now he's looking pretty battered because it's quite clear the street is not going to take any more of his nonsense. And they even tried to organize a kind of a pro-Martelly demonstration last week. I think that was on the 10th or maybe on the 9th. And they didn't get more than 200 people out there. And basically they had to disperse because they were being stoned by the onlookers. So this is stoned and heckled. So this is essentially, I think he's, it's just a matter of time of when he will leave. It's very similar to 1986 when Jean-Claude was going. He got through demonstrations in November and December, but then during the month of January and the beginning of February, they just grew and grew, and eventually he left on February 7th.
Well, since the Clintons and Ambassador Pamela Ann White are so involved in Haiti, what has been demonstrated as their particular, their more favorable plan? What is their plan for Mr. Martelly?
Well, I think at this point they'd been hoping to shore him up. And yesterday the core group, as they call it, that is the U.S., France, Canada, Spain, European Union, basically the imperialist community, said, oh, you know, we're going to go forward with Martelly and we have to, you know, we support him 100%, 150%, blah, blah, blah. But I think in reality, they see he is a lame duck. He's not going to last that long. It's like when you're hunting and you shoot the deer, they'll keep running for 200 or 300 yards dead. But fact is, I don't think they're going to get through with him. That's not my assessment. That's my assessment. I will be very surprised if he can weather this storm. I think the approach that they're going to take, Utrice, is the Lavalas family, against which they've fomented two coups d'etats in the past 20 years, I think they're finally, basically Aristide's vision is very much like that of Toussaint Louverture. He's not a super revolutionary. He's not asking, you know, he's not Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez. He's simply saying, you know, we want to raise up the people from abject misery to dignified poverty. We'll work with you, and he's ready to work with the international community, with the U.S. He's not anxious to break from the empire, as it were. And so, but they've never trusted him. They've never liked him because of his appeal to the masses, with the masses, because he can't be easily controlled in that sense. So they've that's why they've made the two coups against him. But ironically, I think they may have nowhere to turn now, and they may turn to Fahmy Lavalas, who, as I said, has been the most moderate, and ask them to, somehow, some way, save the situation and, you know, keep Haiti within the imperial orbit, because the way things are going, it could very quickly go out of the orbit and end up in an orbit with Venezuela, Cuba, and Bolivia, and become a liability, as it were, in what the U.S. considers its pond. So I think they're sitting right now in meetings saying, you know, how are we going? And apparently, according to my sources in Haiti, many of whom are actually working in Haiti, Liberté, there has been just a constant parade of the international community, everybody from the head of MINUSTA, Sandra Honoré, Trinidadian lady, to Pamela White, et cetera, going by Aristide's house, you know, putting some kind of pressure on him. I'm sure, is being asked to somehow come to Martelly's rescue, or at the very least, and that's the, in addition to Lamotte and Martelly, the people want to see the MINUSTA out. So they might be saying, listen, we'll get rid of Martelly, but at least keep MINUSTA there, at least keep us here, and do an election with us, because the people are saying they don't want MINUSTA there to do another election, because it's messed up all the elections Haiti's tried to do in the years it's been there.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll discuss why Haiti matters right after this. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, our guest, veteran journalist Kim Ives, editor with Haiti Liberté, a news weekly serving the Haitian diaspora. He's just returned from Haiti and following up on previous reports on the situation, the ever-changing landscape in Haiti. This time, we're looking at the political earthquake.
Oh, I should also add that, in fact, Haiti Liberté mostly is distributed in Haiti itself, even though it is also in the diaspora.
Great. Thank you. Why is this important? Why is it important to track what's going on in Haiti from your perspective, Kim?
Well, Haiti is, I can say, a vanguard nation. It is often the leader of movements worldwide. We can see it began the liberation process in Latin America. It was the first, we could say, real revolution in the Americas. If we look at the U.S. revolution as more of a counter-revolution, as Gerald Horn has so brilliantly shown in his recent book. I'm sure you probably had him as your guest already.
Yes, yes, you did.
Yes. And it was led the resistance to the U.S. imperial adventures in Latin America and Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and other countries around the world back at the in the early 1900s. And it has, as well, a tremendous geopolitical importance because it is right there in the middle of the chain of islands, Cuba, Hispaniola, that's the name Columbus gave it, the Indians who lived on the island, the Native Americans called it Haiti, which is what the freed slaves of the new nation of Haiti renamed it, or went back to that original name of the Indians. Again, very different from the U.S. Revolution, which saw the Indians on their continent as savages. And the geopolitical importance of that nation makes it right on the Windward Passage, again, the direct shipping route from the east coast of the United States to the Panama Canal, makes it also very important.
Are you there? Oh, I'm not hearing you. Okay, Kim, are you there?
Oh, Eutrice?
Yes, we kind of lost you there for a minute.
Sorry, we were briefly disconnected there. I had a call, and I tried to block it, and I ended up going to it by mistake. yes, as I was saying, so it's not just that geopolitical position right there on the Windward Passage going to the Panama Canal, but you know, sharing the island of Hispaniola with the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic is a huge asset to the empire, we can say. Many of the firms that had been based on Cuba before its revolution fled to the Dominican Republic and into Puerto Rico just beyond it. So in many ways, if Haiti were to become a renegade state, as its people would like, I believe, in the sense of an anti-imperialist state, this would have a tremendous effect on the Dominican Republic, where I also spent some time this past week, which is suffering from its own problems, and many Haitians essentially live and work in the Dominican Republic. So if you were to, quote-unquote, lose Haiti, if the empire were to lose Haiti, that would also have a tremendous effect on the Dominican Republic and maybe by extension on Puerto Rico just a little further on. So I think Haiti, as one of the most populous nations in the Caribbean, has a tremendous role for the U.S.
We had talked before about this poor, very rich nation. Could we revisit that a bit and talk about why this nation, who that is said to be the poorest in the hemisphere, or among the poorest in the hemisphere, is also actually one of the richest?
Well, you know, I think it was Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan writer, who said, "It is our wealth that is the cause of our poverty." In many ways, the Haitian culture, as the oldest in the Caribbean and Latin America, has very rich, deep roots. Many of its writers influenced writers in Europe and America. I mean, James Audubon was from Haiti, but there are many others. It has a huge intellectual tradition. Haitians, you will find even the poorest among them are always trying to go to school, are always in school. They might be working two jobs, but they'll also be doing some kind of course, some kind of schooling. So you have this a real ethic in Haitian culture to enrich your mind, enrich your life through education. And so this is one thing that makes Haiti rich. But the other thing is the artistic tradition. Of course, you have great art collections, which are nothing but Haitian art. And, you know, the Haitian artists have been celebrated worldwide for their tremendous contribution to art. And I think if you go around the Caribbean, whether it's the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico or any of the other islands, oftentimes you'll see Haitian art, which is presented as, one could say, Caribbean art. So this tradition, I can say, has made Haitians famous worldwide, maybe larger than their population of about 10 million would suggest. And finally, I would say, Utrice, that you will find Haitians working everywhere. They are truly a people which is, I'm looking for the word, adventurous. You know, you will find them, as I may have said it on your show once, I once found Haitians working in a hotel in Boise, Idaho, of all places. You can find them in any state of the United States. You'll find them throughout Latin America. You'll find them throughout Africa and Europe. I don't know about Asia, but I would not be surprised if there were Haitians working in, I don't know, Bangkok. You know, this is truly a people which have penetrated throughout the international working class, and this is another reason that Haiti is so important and so wealthy.
I was also referring to its mineral wealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is true also. There is, it's hard to get hard facts on it, but as we talked in one of our shows, there is believed to be large deposits of oil underneath, particularly the Etang Sumac in the, just outside of Port-au-Prince, and in the bay of Port-au-Prince, in that sort of mouth area of Haiti. In addition to that, there is believed to be about $20 billion of gold dust in the mountains of Haiti. Many of the major veins of gold were mined by the Spanish and French, who Columbus introduced onto the island. But and there's a lot of gold mining going on in the neighboring Dominican Republic. But this is also one of the reasons that the U.S. is very interested in Haiti, and also, I should say, Canadian mining firms in particular. And there's also said to be, I heard this from Aristide himself, uranium in those hills, as well as other sort of more specialized things like very special type of marble and copper, as well as nickel. So there is mineral wealth there, and a lot of it has remained due to Haiti's rebel nature unexploited.
Well, we've talked about the U.S. Hands-on manipulations, political manipulations and machinations in Haiti. But Haiti being a former so-called colony of France, what is the role of France currently?
Well, France has really, I could say, since the U.S. occupation of 1915 to 1934, kind of taken a back seat to the U.S. presence. France had always been, after the revolution in 1804, France remained, for the Haitian ruling class, sort of the country of reference. In 1825, President Boyer signed an accord which established the infamous independence debt of Haiti, where basically 90 million francs, equivalent to about $21 billion, was paid to the French. In fact, it had a lot of role in building the French Empire and its power. So that all changed once the U.S. came in, more or less under the Monroe Doctrine, took Haiti back for U.S. interest. So France now plays more of a role of just trying to keep Haiti as a, at least nominally, French-speaking nation. You know, the Francophonie, as it's called, the French-speaking nations are dwindling in size. The French language is gradually shrinking and dying as more and more of the world speaks either, or more of the Western world, I should say, speaks mostly English or Spanish. So the French do what they can to, you know, show films and have book fairs and have all kinds of cultural things to sort of celebrate the French roots of Haiti. But they do have some, you'll find in Haiti a lot of French sort of, what would I call them, boutique tourism, perhaps. You know, you'll find a lot of French tourist bourgeois, I guess you could call them, who set up a little hotel on a Haitian beach somewhere, usually pretty remote. And, you know, so you will find a number of French people and French capital involved in tourism. But it's as I say, much less than it was prior to the U.S. occupation of 1915 to 1934.
Well, finally, I want to follow up on the question that we left hanging the last time, and that is, when will Clinton go?
When will he go back or go out of Haiti once and for all?
Go out of Haiti.
Well, you know, he since that, I think word must have gotten back to him. I'll tell you, when he made that statement, I was in New York, and going around the streets of Brooklyn, as I tend to do in New York, I had more people come up to me and just say, Bill Clinton is a son of a gun, and he better not go back to Haiti. And these were people who maybe just a few years ago would have said, oh, Bill Clinton, he's the one who brought Aristide back in 1994. So I think somehow, you know, I was really very surprised that Bill Clinton was so politically stupid to make that comment as Laurent Lamothe was being chased out of the country. Now, you know, he does have a lot of lives, it's for sure, political lives, more than a cat for sure. And you know, maybe he'll find some way to pull it back. But I really do feel, Utrice, that we are on the cusp of a major sea change in Haiti, maybe the world. I mean, I think, you know, there is a real worldwide wind. I think they've been saying this in the last show, if my memory now is serving me, where, you know, we see uprisings in the U.S. and around the globe. And I think Haiti is, again, in the vanguard on this. There is a real weariness with, you know, U.S. Meddling and U.S. browbeating and U.S. bribing and U.S. butting into Haiti. And I think that the Haitian people are really interested right now in moving in a direction which is going to leave them more sovereignty, more democracy, and more justice. And therefore, I think the role of the Clintons is on the wane in Haiti, no matter what.
Well, that's a hopeful note on which to end the program today. Thank you so much, Kim, for being with us. Kim Ives, editor with Haiti Liberté, the news weekly that serves Haitians. I've just changed that little introduction of yours there.
Thank you.
So thank you so much again for being with us, especially since you probably didn't even get a full night's sleep coming back. So thank you again, and we'll talk again soon.
Yes, it's for sure. Nobody's getting much sleep in Haiti or anybody involved in the political scene right now. It's a sleepless period.
Thank you so much, Kim, for being with us again.
Okay, so long, Utrice. Bye. Thank you.
This brings us to the end of our program today. It was yet another primer, and we've been following the events in Haiti, but from a very different perspective, so that you have a comprehensive view of what's happening. And what is emerging, I hope you were able to detect that, what is emerging is that the picture that we have of Haiti is decidedly different from what Haiti really is. It is not a backward nation in that sense. It is a nation that has been forced by a concatenation of conspirators coming together to retard justice, to delay justice, to even destroy the possibility of justice in Haiti. And still, the beautiful thing is the continued resistance against it. And that is why we pay attention to Haiti. I want to thank you for joining me today, as every day. Tomorrow, of course, you know, is Free Your Mind Friday. So we'll pick up on your take of the news tomorrow. Until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.